Hey, we're speaking with Josh DeChellis, executive chef at Sumile.
Sumile Sushi, officially.
Sumile Sushi, okay.
Sumile Sushi.
Sumile Sushi.
Yeah, we've installed the sushi bar out front, and we have a real kick-ass sushi chef, and Trey from Ginza, and we're really happy to have this element to our sushi or to our restaurant now.
How does a guy from New Jersey go to cooking Japanese food?
Oh God. You know, I don't really know. Just a lot of, I think, you know, a lot of the chefs that I ended up working for weren't really tied down to a specific genre of cooking, which is probably what led me to them in the first place. But, you know, I think the first thing I saw from a chef in Jersey was, like, you know, something as silly as, like, wasabi mayonnaise or something like that. And from there on is sort of the learning scale or learning curve of the American chef grew, you know, in terms of the Japanese awareness. I sort of soaked up a little bit more and a little bit more, and just it really didn't do anything but pique my interest. And when I moved to San Francisco, and that's really where I was exposed to Japanese culture. I just fell in love with it. Just fell in love. You know, eating sushi in California as compared to eating sushi, you know, here, and we're talking about 10, 12 years ago now, there's a huge difference, you know, huge difference. It's because there's, you know, like here, there's like a lot of European people. You know, you go, you can go places to find a great steak free. Like, you know, out there, like to go find like a great oyakodon. It's like that not too big of a deal, but here, back then it was impossible, you know.
And how different do you think Japanese food is in Japan in comparison to what people are doing here today?
Night and day, yeah. Probably. Just nothing. Yeah, just nothing short of night and day.
So, and you're picking out the kind of food that you want to do. Are you calling it fusion, or is it really Japanese?
Well, I mean, like I'll call it fusion. I'm not afraid of fusion as a word. I'm not embarrassed by it at all, like a lot of people are. I think the thing with, you know, with Japanese, you know, I think if you were to take a Japanese chef and just plop them right here on 13th Street and have him start cooking, you would probably find that he would, after a couple of days of wandering, have made his way to the green market and, like, you know, laboriously picked through the radishes and found, like, the best one and just very simply presented it. And, you know, the same thing with the fish and such. I don't really think Japanese, you know, cooking as a philosophy is so much about the ingredients or flavor profiles, in my interpretation, as it is about, you know, how to handle, select, and sort of treat food, I suppose. And that's really, you know, to do as little to it as possible. And that's really just about showcasing, you know, Mother Nature and whatever particular season you might be in or some particular region. And that's a huge part of Japanese cooking. And that's why it could never be emulated very specifically here. You know, you have things like ramen. You know, all of Japan is pretty familiar with ramen, but there's certain places that are just really known for ramen, and like you go there and it's like, why? Because they take the water from one specific spring that comes from this one mountain, and you know the water has been tested, and you know it suits. That's why they made ramen to begin with. It's because it, you know, came from this water and, you know, happened to be suitable best for that style of noodle. And there's a lot of things in Japan like that.
Well, you worked in France and as well as here in the United States. Do you think you find that Japanese is more similar than French in the fact that there's a ceremony or a classic tradition behind it?
There's definitely, you know, it's funny. There's definitely egos driving both of them. I think the ego in the Japanese kitchen is a little different than the French ego. And it's bizarre because the French or the Japanese are so, you know, tied to their tradition, generally speaking. Of course, that's just a very wide statement. But they're, you know, they're generally very tied to tradition and, you know, like to represent it as it's been represented by the person who showed them and showed them. It's a very beautiful thing. And in France, it's like a little more regionally based, and like, you know, there's always like a little spin that the chef puts on it, you know, usually a little spin of some kind. And that's, you know, a very personal ego. But they both seem to really be tied to their tradition. I think France a little less now, because, I mean, just think about where they are geographically, and they're surrounded by influence. In Japan, you know, Jesus. Politically and geographically, they've, you know, they're sort of secluded. You know, they sort of secluded themselves over the past century, and, you know, geographically, of course, they're pretty isolated. So that, you know, naturally, now it's a little different in terms of communications, with the internet and everything. They're sort of grabbing a lot more influence now, but that's a fairly new thing for them.
Yeah, because I worked with some Japanese guys at Sony, and one of them being Morimoto, and I noticed, like, I mean, he was on the Iron Chef, and you could see how much they were picking up just being here, and then, but yet how tied down they were to that tradition that they had, that really clean, really, really simple, but super elegant food.
Yeah, well, and I think you just nailed what makes Japanese food so attractive, is that it sort of transcends all trends. By respecting and just trying to showcase, you know, the beautiful things that come from nature, gives it like a timeless beauty. You know, there's you know, certain plate compositions that, you know, come and go. You know, whether it be when everything was stacked architecturally, or, you know, the sauces were put on in squeeze bottles and made these different designs, and even the some of the crazy scientifically inspired creations that are coming out, you know, those things are wild, and they all are beautiful in their own right, I suppose, but there's something that will remain a timeless beauty about Japanese food to me, where, you know, if you take a piece of fish from the sea, and it comes, you know, at the best time of year for that fish, and it's the right breed, it's the right age, it's the right weight, it's had the right diet, and then you slice it open, and then you let it rest for the right amount of time, and then you present it like that. I mean, there's going to be something beautiful about that 2 centuries ago, and, you know, hopefully 2 centuries from now, if the ocean has any more fish left in it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, because you'd mentioned that you, it was an article I read about, where you were saying that your food cost is at 23%, and you were talking about using other fish rather than what's, you know, the common, you know, like a black sea bass or something, and where you were using corvina. I said, wow, corvina, that's cool. It's a fish that I saw in Latin America, and I thought was a really good fish. You know,
it's an awesome fish.
And which people won't really receive as much here. I think, I mean, for the market that I'm serving, it's a little bit like, what the hell is that, you know?
You got to be creative, I think, with, like, what you sort of, how you spin it, you know, too. And, you know, of course, you get in the territory of, like, you know, truth and menu, and you certainly don't want to be feeding somebody something that, you know, is different than what you tell them they're eating. But, you know, there's like a little latitude, you know, and it's like, don't take what I'm saying the wrong way, because, like, you know, like, every fucking chef does it. You know, like Mario Batali, you know, you go to his restaurant and you see, like, you know, like a lupa, you know, L-O-U-P-A on the menu, you know, that's wolf fish.
Yeah.
You know, some people call love. What's that one? The one that gives you the poops. Is it cobia?
Oh, God.
What is it? Oh, escalar.
Right, right. The oily fish.
Yeah. I've seen that, you know, and I've seen people call that white tuna.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like people, they eat it, and like the fish is fine. You know, I'm not saying, suggesting go to that extreme, but you can be a little creative, I think,
sure.
You know.
Okay.
All in the name of education.
Of course. And that's what cooking's about, is educating yourself.
Well, here, Sumile is very different because, you know, at Sumile Sushi, people come here and they have, you know, people who know where they're going, they sort of know what they're kind of foodies. So, you know, we don't really have to do that, you know. People enjoy knowing exactly, like, oh, what is that thing? Oh, how weird. I've never had that. Like, we get a lot of that crowd here, which is awesome. But at other restaurants, it's a problem. Like I'm saying, you know, it's like, you know, halibut's at $11.50 this week. Like, I'm not spending $11.50 on halibut because I don't want to charge $45 to my guest. And I don't want to suck it up on my end either. So then you have to look for alternative, and then, boom, there you go. You're looking at the Corvina.
Yeah.
Or the wolffish.
Sure.
Or, you know, some of the
other... Even though that's getting the fish to death.
The wolffish is?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Oh, not wolffish. I'm thinking the Chilean sea bass.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's done.
Yeah, the toothfish,
it's like,
yeah.
It's like done.
Yeah.
Dude, do you know the wolffish?
Yeah, it's got the really big... I've
the
tried
big teeth
it once,
and the
yeah,
big cheeks.
And my boss is like, oh, that's horrible fish. I'm like, what are you crazy? It's delicious.
Oh, yeah. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's like one of my favorite bycatch.
It's like even like a cod cheeks or halibut cheeks.
Yeah.
And people are like... I love those things.
There's a good fish right now that comes from the Florida coast. I don't know if it's exactly Atlantic or the Gulf or somewhere in between, but it's a Jack Trevally.
Uh-huh.
It's like $1.75 a pound.
Wow.
And it's like...
It's don't tell anybody.
It's like, it's awesome. Like,
right.
I want everybody to get it so we, you know, so more people's, you know, have it. It's like... I don't know, man. It's like a pink hamachi. It's sort of like a nairagi, which is the striped marlin that comes from Hawaii. It's amazing, man.
Huh.
You should check that out.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to write that one down.
You should check that out.
Well, Japanese food has like a really incredible pantry of items, and I noticed that one of them that you mentioned, something I read, was nori, which you really love a lot.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of your favorite things.
Oh, yeah. I live
what are some
stuff.
Of the things that you can do with nori besides the typical maki roll or something?
God, you tell me, you know. It's like sky's the limit. We do a lot with nori powder here. Because, you know, the way nori is put together, there's like a lot of air in it, even in the leaf. So when you grind it, it's sort of, you know, the granules are so small they fall more on top of each other and it just becomes like a much stronger flavor. And it's great, just the texture. We use it to flavor and thicken sauces. I also mix it with salt to make nori salt, which is a really awesome way to, you know, just let the salinity pick up a little flavor as it melts on your tongue. And I use nori powder with pumpkin seed powder, and it's like a base of my what I call my Japanese blackening powder. It's based on nori powder.
Sure.
Beyond that, what else do we do with it? You know, we use it. You know, I use it in the bottom of covered pots to cook. You know, to cook fish with, and different meats. I suppose that's about it currently.
This is a question that I kind of wrote up here, and I'm going to see if it makes any sense to you. Do the flavors of products differentiate the way you prepare the food, or is it the techniques or the method?
Repeat that one more time.
Okay. Do the flavors of the products differentiate the way you prepare the food, or is it the techniques or method? As like, you know, if you're...
Definitely the product dictates the handling.
Okay.
Every time. Every single time.
And in your preparation for what you're doing here at Sumile, are you using a combination of Western and Japanese, or are you trying to...
I don't... Like, as far as technique... Or is ingredients?
Both, yeah. Both.
Well, in terms of ingredients, I don't, you know, I'm like so blind to where, you know, it's like, for me, it's, you know, it's all about the sensation of taste. And taste, you know, it's a study that's, you know, way far behind all the other senses, like, you know, hearing and sight and all that. But, there's just as much going on, you know, in your tongue as your eyes, and there's a few people that know quite a bit about it. I'm not one of them, unfortunately. But you know, your taste buds don't care, you know, where something came from. When it's in your mouth, they don't care. They're tasting, you know, the flavor profile, however it might be made up, whether naturally or if you've changed something somehow, which it brings me to technique, you know. Like, I don't, you know, there's, it doesn't matter, you know, what, it's just all about, like, how you taste something, you know, how you might want to prepare it, how you might need to prepare it, you know, for a certain event or for a certain menu slot or something, and then whatever technique you know, maybe you invent a technique or, you know, bastardized one.
Or you fall into it. It just was a mistake.
Or you fall into one.
Go, right? How did I do that?
Those are like some of the best ones, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I just, you know, it's all about the product. And then, you know, taking it from there.
Yeah, because I remember, I mean, having worked with a few different chefs, and one particular who told me that, you know, there's a lot of things about how Americans perceive food, and it's got to be really beautiful, it's got to stand out, and where he was saying, you know, for me, that's a complete opposite. It has to taste good first. To really be a beautiful dish.
You know what? Somebody said to me, God, what was that? This was like 4 years ago. Somebody said to me, oh, it was a food writer. Well, I'll never say who it was. But they said to me, like, oh, well, you know, flavor's really coming back. Like, I'm just like, what? I'm like, what? You know? And I'm like young and like trying to make a good impression, you know? Sorry, like a big smile on my face, you know. I just found that to be so weird. And it's like you were saying, you know, I guess we just go through these trends or fads, you know. Like, I think we're in one right now where technique is like superseding composition, and I don't, you know what, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, you know, because it's unfortunate because nobody regulates who's using these techniques and how, but you know, the development of these new techniques are just groundbreaking, and it's just so awesome to see from a chef's perspective, because, you know, whether or not the techniques that they're, you know, some of these chefs are creating now are, you know, whether or not that, like, application will be, like, forever used or not, you know, this stuff is going to, like, these techniques are going to change the way people eat in the future, you know, hopefully for the better, you know.
talking about that, using the different new things that are coming out, a lot of people are doing this like laboratory so-called cuisine, kind of like Frankensteinish stuff. I mean, I've read some things and I kind of, okay, does it really make sense? And I've been a little bit negative, but I'm trying to keep an open mind about it.
You know,
I mean,
think
you're smooshing like muscles into like paper, and it's like, does it make sense? Is it really a shock value? Kind of like Nouvelle Cuisine used to be.
Yeah, I think, I look at it much different than the applications that, you know, are being used right now. And like some of them are, you know, just simply like everybody, you know, now they love to talk about the phone like a bad thing. And it's like, that just makes me so, so disappointed, you know, to hear people say that, you know, because just that was something that was never, that was a texture that was never achieved before. Like how are you ever gonna, you know, how you, what, like, you know, are you gonna bash the custard now? You know what I mean? It's like, it's that groundbreaking. It's like, here's, you know, the custard. Take the hollandaise, for example.
Yeah.
That lusciousness and that texture with that body and the lightness. I mean, and the richness, you know, like that's, and it's something, you know, whatever you call it, a mother sauce in classic, you know, cooking. And it would be like bashing that, you know, like that was, you know, that the foam will be just, you know, like an elemental thing, you know, later, you know, that will, people will build on. Like a lot of people now are just like, oh, it's the foam, you know. I haven't even seen anybody like, oh, like, let me take that foam and fold in a puree and use it like a classic chaboust.
Right.
You know, maybe that foam is used instead of egg whites in a beignet batter, so you have like a nice flavor. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's like this, somebody's created something that, you know, it's awesome. You know, and like the you know, the, and it's crazy now, you know, you read it, it's like the spherification things that that Wiley's doing, and you know, Ferran and his crew over there, and I mean, it's wild, man. You know, like, who, like, I think that, you know, somewhere along the way, somebody's gonna be doing something. They're gonna stumble along, you know, upon something. We're like, oh my God, you know what? By do, you know, if I took this and did this, like, I could ship like nutrients over to like third world countries and have them be sustainable for the journey and have a shelf life and retain their nutritional value. You know, something, like something really, really, really
important
is going to come from that. You know, like, you know, whether it's going to be how people eat every day or to solve, you know, different eating problems, you know.
Well, one of the methods I noticed that you used when you were at Union Pacific was a sous vide, and you were talking about how they did a poor man's version, where you'd wrap the food in plastic and throw it in a really hot oven.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, for me, I think sometimes I have even tried at home with Ziploc bags, and I cook vegetables, and it tastes really great. But then I get like kind of worried. I go, oh my God, is it going to be like a Teflon pan plastic? Is it really good for you? Is it really not a natural product where it could really...
So, you know, it's funny you say that. I've never thought of that. That's a great call. After doing so much with sous vide, a while ago, it was just like an epiphany at one point. I was just like, man, like this isn't natural. Like this is, there's something is not right here. Like, you know, and it's just, it was, you know, I just had this big idea that I didn't want to do sous vide anymore. And that sort of, but sous vide was important to me because it brought me to other techniques. You know, if I look at why cooking proteins or any cell structure in that method, like why it yields such a great product. You know, you look at the slow even cooking, you know, the no transferring of flavor or loss of its own flavor, no need for added fats, and you know, the even cooking and the atmospheric pressure change due to the absence of the of a lot of the air. And that got me thinking, like, okay, well, like, I know why it works really well. Like, what can I do in, like, a more natural medium? And it brought me, you know, to this old idea of covered pot cooking, not just with a lid, but with a piece of dough to form, like, a hermetic seal around it with egg.
Like that old pate thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the idea is you just put like a little water under there, or stock, or any kind of liquid that you want. And, you know, I started doing it with pine and cedar, and then, you know, putting loins of venison in there, and then covering it really well. And then just, so, you know, it was sitting on a basically a rack of the pine and the cedar, and it had a little bit of liquid underneath, and then it was covered, and we put it under the flame, like, really hot for a sec, so it would just basically boil the water, so, but there was a total hermetic seal around it, so because the water expanded and steamed, it, you know, it created this atmospheric pressure change that was, you know, sort of like became more dense around the protein, so it wouldn't let some things out and would sort of coddle it differently and let the heat go through sort of evenly. And then we just, you know, did it really slow in the oven after that.
With the hermetic steel
still on it.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, it was like one of the best things that I've ever done, you know. So we pull it out and we just brown it on the top, and then we just shoot it over the flame again real quick to make sure the steam goes up again. And then we turn it right into a table preparation and come out and cut open the top, and then they get, you know, the customer gets this blast of, you know, like a pine
delicious
aromatherapy
smell, yeah,
with the venison. Huh. And, you know, the way the product was cooked was, you know, as good as any sous vide I've ever done.
Yeah, years ago, a friend of ours got this bluefish, which everybody thinks is a totally nasty fish, but he wrapped it in tin foil, threw it directly into the fire of these coals in the grill, and we pulled it out, and I said, God, this is like the most delicious fish I've ever had. Didn't taste. All the oil had burned out, so it was like really just tender, delicious fish.
Wow.
And I tried that in Europe too, but with a sausage my sister had. And I put red wine in a little tin foil, and I threw it right into the coals. And I mean, it was caramelized. It was beautiful. And
oh,
it was
sounds awesome.
Real tasty, yeah.
That's awesome. I love, like, I get it, you know, I got to tell you, that, like, that sort of cooking just is, I just love it, you know. I love it. There's an old French technique called moules a la clod or something. Maybe like in a clod of muscles, and it's you open muscles on a smoldering pine stump. Huh. How fucking awesome is that?
Yeah, it's kind of like a ham and hay that they cook.
How great is it? Yeah. You know, like, I love that kind of stuff. I really love it. You know, it's like you only have one life to live, and I think I can spend this life just sort of enjoying that about cooking rather than dedicating it to, you know, like a lot of, you know, other people do, really pushing and pushing as far as techniques go. Like I said, you know, I love them all, and I think it's going to yield to be something very important. But, yeah, I'd just as soon sit around and chuck sausages in the fire with red wine myself.
Yeah, it's pretty tasty.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. It sounds great. Just, I love it. I love it.
What kind of things would it take for somebody at home to do, I mean, not really copying your food, but doing Asian food or Japanese food per se, and what would you need in your pantry? What are the essential items you think you'd want to have?
There's a few. There's definitely, you know, some different soy sauces, which is for, like, just to hear, for a lot of people to hear, you know, different shoyus, different soys, is, you know, an education for them. There's a lot of different ones. There's light ones, there's dark ones, there's aged ones, there's, you know, ones that are made
tamari.
With wheat. Yeah, there's the tamari. There's the quote-unquote white soys. And, you know, I think if you just have, like, the tamari, a light soy, and a white soy, you are so good to go. And the other ones, you know, it's always great to have some frozen, fresh frozen wasabi in the freezer, some Japanese mustard, and a few condiments. One called, you know, yuzu kosho, which is a paste that, you know, has a really long shelf life. It's a spicy citrus paste. It's a red one, a green one, and I think that's about it. And then, you know, all the other things that that sort of exist in the American pantry can be substituted, you know, again, if you just think in terms of, like, flavor profile, like, maybe you're not using mirin, maybe you use some diluted acacia honey in a dish, you know, to balance the salinity of the soy sauce or something.
Or agave nectar, maybe.
Whatever it might be, whatever it might be. And then, you know, those different ingredients, those different sweet ingredients, you would grab one just thinking naturally, like, well, is the agave nectar really going to taste good with whatever, this frog leg that you're treating with tamari?
Yeah.
Or should the sweetness come from, you know, pine honey? Yeah. Or should it come from molasses?
Right.
Or should it come from sugar, you know?
Yeah, because I found that I've been to places where people are trying to do a fusion cuisine or a real combination of so many different cuisines. And for me, being a chef, I kind of go into restaurants trying to be really open-minded, but it's hard sometimes because you're really trying to pick things apart in your palate and your mind, too. And I went to one particular place over on the other side of town, and I said, God, there's something wrong with this. It doesn't taste. It shouldn't be like this. Is it hard to put together the Japanese with the Western, or is it hard to put the Western into the Japanese since there's so many differences?
Well, you're talking to me like every dish we do is a success to everybody. And I don't think that's what, you know, here at Sumile Sushi, we simply don't strive for that. That's not, the food created here isn't created for everyone. Taste is subjective enough, you know. People have opinions on French fries. You know what I mean?
It's freedom fries.
You know, it's like you got the freedom fries and like people like have debates over those, you know, minuscule debates, you know, obviously not over soggy and crisp. But you know what I'm saying? And then they come in here to a place like this and, you know, someone's going to be like, oh my God, like why is there this, first of all, this egg custard is really loose. Oh, it's too loose. It looks broken. You know, somebody will think that. And then somebody will think like, well, God, like, you know, and there's clam in here and it's, and there's duck in there too. Like, I don't like clam with my duck. And you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
It's just, we just simply can't, let me rephrase that. We won't subscribe to, at this restaurant, cooking every dish to please everyone. Of course, there's really poor business sense in subscribing to that entirely. So, you know, we do, you know, retain things, you know, like our steak preparation, our chicken preparation, our salad preparation. You know, we like to keep things, as accessible as possible to as many different sort of palates as possible. So, you know, people will be able to have something not so, you know, esoteric maybe. We keep the seats filled. I mean, that's important as well, you know.
Yeah. And you think it's... It's kind of a good thing to have a lot of foodies kind of with their ears down to the ground seeing what restaurants are doing. Is it keep restaurants in line, or are they just a little bit too fussy sometimes?
I was thinking about that today, actually. You know, as if the reviewers aren't bad enough. And I shouldn't even say bad enough. As if it's not stressful enough. Being a chef in the kind of restaurant where people sort of like look at it and, like you're saying, like, you know, dissect it a little bit, you know, it's pretty hard sometimes, you know. It's pretty hard. Of course it's great when they love it, but no restaurant will ever have, you know, universally good things said about it. I guess that's just something that, you know, as a chef you really need to to learn really quick and to understand so you can live happily, because you know, you're a professional chef, and you know, you go in and your paperwork's done, and you know, you the night before last you fought it out with your fish guy to get the best, you know, piece of mackerel that came into the market, and you know, you're all suited up, and there it is, this beautiful mackerel that he promised, and you do your preparation, and then you read about it the next day on some blog, like just somebody so matter-of-factly saying why the dish was no good. Yeah, so I guess, I don't even know where I was, but you know, it's important. Oh, it's stupid for... I shouldn't even say that. It's not... For me, it's when my personal emotion is at the right place, I find it helpful to read them. After all, it's feedback, and I think that's really important for, you know, for a chef. You know, there's times in the back where, you know, you're tasting so much, and you know, you might think you even tasted the dish. You might think like, wow, that went out balanced, but you know, you had added, you know, a little more yuzu juice or lemon juice to something because you thought it needed the acidity, but your palate already was drenched with something. Sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that stuff could be off. You know, it's important, and I don't think it's prudent to just dismiss all of them. But at the same time, it's hard, and yeah. You really have to. Like it took me a while to just eventually say, like, to myself, like, all right, like to eventually get it, you know, to be like, okay, like, you know, that's it's not changing anything, you know, appreciate it for what it is, feedback, but then, you know, you just can't take it personal, but it's really hard not to.
Sure.
And you know, of course, there's still times where I do take it personally, then you have to step back and just sort of,
you know. Yeah, and sometimes you have to really literally take what people say with a grain of salt as well.
Oh, you do?
I mean, that sounds like a real pun, but it's true. Yeah. I had read that you said that your mom was a really terrible cook.
Oh, awful.
How then did you develop your taste, and are you still developing it? I mean, cooking was a learning curve, I think. But, I mean, you've gotten pretty far up in the rung of the ladder in the business, so... And you know what I've read seems like really great press and stuff. So how did you find that you developed that taste?
I don't know. I think a lot of people come to certain dishes, you know, from many, like, from totally different paths, you know. Line up 10 chefs and they all make, you know, a dish, and it's a little different. And, you know, there's so much baggage that's brought, you know, that they bring with them to where, you know, to get them to that one dish. You know, for me, I think what gets me to any dish I do is just a love for just about anything that you can eat. You know, I love food so much. Like, it's like I have to be really careful. If it was up to me, I would eat like 6 times a day. Like 3 of those meals would be like dinners. And I just think, you know, just loving food so much and eating so much, you know, makes, you know, enables me to serve something, you know, very simply adorned or not adorned at all. Like, I had, God, what did I have the other day? I had a undressed salad. And man, was it good. I forgot, like, how good that was. When I was growing up, I hated dressing on salad. I hated salt on salad. And I forgot how great it was. And it just brought me, like, you know, all the way back there, you know, it was really cool. You know, so I can, you know, I can be really happy serving that to someone, you know, at the same time where, you know, when I pair different flavors that might not be traditionally paired with each other, it just comes, you know, from a very genuine place with me, just like I said, just after eating, you know, just and thinking about the different flavor profiles of different things, you know, it just would spark in my head, like, you know, I think that would taste really, like, I think melon pickled in a spicy citrus paste is going to taste really good with, you know, a piece of fish and some nori salt to ground it. Like, I think that would be really good.
And yeah, it was interesting that you talked about the nori salt, too, because I was in Ecuador, and we went to this place where it's called Vilcabamba, and these people live till over 100 years old, and it's really peaceful, beautiful. It's an incredible valley. It's just really, the weather there is just amazing. You go in, and you at first go, oh, boy, it's some hokey thing, and then you go, wow, it's really true. It's like, really amazing area.
Wow. And we what do they eat? What's their diet like?
You know, I don't know, but I had, like, this great stuff called borapo, which is like a cane alcohol.
Oh.
And my brother-in-law has asthma, and he got this special cane alcohol with, like, some kind of, like,
the asthmatic
weird
version?
No, yeah, and the guy was, like, you know, he's, like, this weird shaman kind of guy with a really freaky little beard, and he was talking about how, it has coca leaves in it. I said, oh, there you go.
There you go.
And my brother-in-law tasted it at first and goes, well, it's really, like, horrible. And he goes, oh, no, put some, like, lemon juice, and he was, like, telling him how to make this cocktail and stuff, and but we got this, like, salt there, and it was, like, a vegetable salt, and I said, this is really weird, and I thought about how food is so interrelated on our planet. I mean, we had this fruit there that we saw, and it was only grown in this one particular town where my wife is from, and I was telling my mom about it, and she's from the south of France, and she goes, oh, I know that, we have that fruit, too. And I said, what? So I kind of looked it up, and I found out that it was originally from Malaysia. And they have it in the Mediterranean, and then they also have it in South America.
What fruit is this?
It's called Pomarosa.
Pomarosa.
And it's this really small, strange-looking fruit, very small, round. God, I couldn't even describe what it is. It has, like, these little purple dots on it, and inside is, like, a little nut. And you eat the outer core.
Flesh?
Yeah, the flesh. And it's kind of reminded me of a water chestnut, but, like, an apple smell, just amazing, just the most bizarre stuff I've ever had. And
I love things.
And
so
it was like the end of the season, so my brother-in-law was throwing like tree branches at it to get these things down, and he goes, oh, I used to get these when I was a kid. So
that's funny.
Yeah. So you were born in Colombia.
Yeah, in Bogota.
And how, I mean, do you ever eat like Colombian food here? Or
I don't even know what Colombian food is.
Oh, okay.
Maybe, like, you know, one day maybe that'll be like, oh, maybe I should go eat some Colombian.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm very, very involved with other things.
Yeah. Do you ever cook at home, or are you just like too busy and basically eating?
When
out
I cook at home, I do cook at home sometimes. My wife and I actually are moving into our first house, so we'll have an actual real kitchen. I'm so excited about it. But when I cook at home, a lot of it is a lot of it's on the grill, man.
Yeah,
I love cooking outside. I love cooking over live wood. You know, cooking on a grill to me, like, is sort of like you throwing your sausage into the fires. You are, like, you know, you're just sort of participating in
the primal
exactly.
Cooking
it's
need.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and there's intelligent ways to go about it. You know, there's things that I've, you know, thankfully know about the behavior of food, and
sure.
You know, which enables me to make, you know, grilling you know, not so, like, bad, I guess. You know, there's, like,
sure.
Really bad grilled food.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun on the grill.
Uh-huh.
A lot of fun.
Okay.
So it's primarily that. And it's all simple, you know. I think my favorite thing to do on the grill is a piece of halibut and some asparagus with soy sauce mixed with lemon and green Tabasco.
Huh.
A little olive oil is probably my favorite.
And who are some of your favorite chefs out there today that are cooking?
Everybody. All of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. All of them. I don't get out to eat as much as I want to. I really want to go to 11 Madison. I really want to go to Crew again. But, you know, Zach Palacios Foods. It's good, you know, interesting, it's organic in feel. I really connect with his food a lot. And
So is there a place where all the chefs like hang out, and is it still Blue Ribbon, the big place where all the chefs go to eat?
No, everybody's going to David's place now, to Sambar.
Okay.
You know, his new Momofuku place.
Right.
That's where they're all hanging out.
Okay.
I'm getting old though, you know, I can't do that stuff so much anymore.
Yeah, I'm kind of like out of the chef realm anyways. I'm in a different world of chefs. So
right.
We're a totally different
different breed
indeed.
yeah, you know, it's like they all go there, and you know, I love it over there. There's still, you know, there's God, I could definitely live my 20s again. Like no problems, eating my way through Chinatown and all the little dirty nooks.
Great Vietnamese restaurants, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're just awesome.
Even Flushing has some good places.
I haven't even done Queens yet.
Yeah.
And I hear that's an
Well,
idiot.
I had asked my last interview at Joey Campanera at the Little Owl.
Oh right, Joey.
And he had mentioned you as well. And,
yeah, I wanted to thank him for that.
And I was telling him, I said, do you think New York is the Manhattan in general is the center of cooking? But do you think there's a chance for the boroughs to really shine and have those great restaurants that Manhattan has? And he said, no. And do you think that'll ever come to fruition? Do you think we'll ever get some decent restaurants in the boroughs?
You know, the reason, eventually maybe, but, you know, traditionally the boroughs have been places for...
Where people live.
The people who live in the boroughs are putting their eggs in different baskets. You know, they generally, you know, move out to get more space, a home, a better school district, you know, a little more of a sane lifestyle to raise their family. And once you have a family, you have different expenses and different priorities. Here in Manhattan, there's this expendable money culture.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're a big, you know, hedge funder boy, you like making like millions in bonuses, and just, you know, spreading gravy all around, just, you know, drinking, you know, the best Pinots around and eating foie gras and caviar every night. Or if you're, you know, like a marketing director somewhere making like $100,000, but like single and buying shoes and going out and like eating like at great sushi places, you know? It's a different lifestyle entirely. Yeah. I don't think we'll ever really.
Yeah, because I think for some of us who are the borough people, we now we're kind of like the bridge and tunnel, and you go, well, hell, I work in Manhattan, you know, but it is a destination kind of thing to go to a really good restaurant. It's you know, you spendable cash. It's like okay.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, it's like let there be beauty in both. You know,
yeah.
Like the boroughs, like, you know,
because in Paris, I noticed when I was there last summer. There's so many restaurants, and, you know, New York has thousands of them, but if you go to Paris, it's a totally different mindset. You'll have a neighborhood restaurant, you'll have, like, the really hyper chic place, but then there'll be a boulangerie on every corner, a pâtisserie, and then you're just like, it's so overwhelming. You go, God, I can't believe how much stuff they have in the city. And here in New York, you kind of go, well, why don't we have that yet? Why don't we have, like, you know, égalité for everybody, you know, for eating?
We do. We don't see it. We don't. Guys like you and me walk around the Place d'Opera, you know, which is even a couple blocks behind it, which isn't, you know, like
human.
You know, and you just like, you know, you're like, man, like, what? Like, why can't I have pad thai on crew?
Yeah.
Like, why can't I just like walk by somewhere and get like, because in Paris, it's about my favorite thing to do, man.
Get like, the tattoo.
Oh, just roll around, just get like different slices of things. Like all their kick-ass charcuterie.
Yeah.
It's like the best. Here, we just don't see it, but, you know, we have pizza. Like, the pizza slice culture is, I mean, that's what New Yorkers here do, and that's, you know, their version of the, you know, the quick pâtés or the quick, you know, the crepes or something, you know.
Sure. And what about Japan? They have that sort of a different thing as well, I guess.
Oh, they got the takoyaki is big, which is the, you know, the little piece of octopus in the ball.
Oh.
But maybe it's not takoyaki. That would be grilled octopus.
Yeah.
There's like the little octopus balls. They're big street food.
Uh-huh.
They ate some crazy shit over there.
Yeah. Oh, well, one of my favorite things actually at Decibel, the sake place, is... The dried squid with the mayonnaise. It's like, My brother saw me eating that. He said, man, it's so gross. I'm like, no, man, it's really good. You got to chew it, man. It's really good. He's like, what is that, like squid jerky? I'm like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
How hard is it to serve wine with the food you guys are doing? Or is it...
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I think one of the... We had a guy who did the opening beverage program for us. His name's George Thomas. One of the biggest pros in town. And he paired with the hamachi dish with pickled melon and the nori salt and nori jus. You know, we were doing our preliminary tastings and he's like, you know, oh, chef, you know, taste this, you know, this is what I'm pairing with your hamachi dish. And I'm like, it's like a Pinot Noir. And I'm like, Georgie, like, he's like, chef, don't say another word, just taste it. You know, and sure enough, I tasted it. And it was brilliant. The way the Pinot worked with the nori, the toastiness of the nori, the depth of the nori, and the fattiness of the fish was priceless. I mean, it was something like a, you know, it takes people like that to like, real, you know, to like, to come up with things like that, you know. I bet if you put like 12, you know, sommeliers, like lined them up in the bar, they all tasted that thing. Four of them would pick Gruners. A couple would pick some Sauv Blancs. You know, maybe one guy would take, you know, tell you like a wheat beer would go real good.
No Zinfandel?
You know, and I think, and it really, you know, you really, just really taste, you know, taste the food. That's what makes good pairings. And so I guess my point is that there is some, there's definitely some hope in there. But it takes not only an open mind to the person, for the person pairing them, but for the person that's being served it as well.
Yeah, sure. And speaking of beer, I read also that you were doing something with beer, and I'm like a beer connoisseur. I drank many a beer in Germany for about three years. So every time I go to get beer, I just like, are you kidding? You can't drink this shit.
So I got Rogue Brewery, one of my favorite breweries. Oh, this is the first draft. This is an exhibit.
The first draft?
Right.
Oh, okay.
So it's done already, but like it'll take me forever to find it. That was something we were looking at. But
and what sort of beer were they going to be making for you?
It's like it's a pale ale. Mm. Basically, I told them, just like, look, guys, I want something that's going to be like aromatic, like a wheat beer, and have like those playful notes, but have body like a pilsner and some bitterness, you know, like a pilsner or a lager. Bitterness of a pilsner and body of a lager, I think I said. It's what they came up with, man, and it's awesome. It's like amazing. It's got, oh, it's crazy. It's got this, because it has the bitterness in the back, you know, you get this cold beer and like, you know, a lot of the stuff I do, I play with, you know, spice and acid, and you know, you take a swig of the beer and it sort of extinguishes the heat, but then with the bitterness in the back, it just sort of grabs onto the heat a little bit too, and it just sort of carries it at the end.
And yeah, because like, I've always noticed with like Japanese food, like even with the rice or like shiso leaves, it goes great with beer. There's like a smokiness, and it just is like, wow.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
I can't wait.
Or that should, Toro.
That should be out in like a month and a half.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, because I tried one at David's at Momofuku. They had this Japanese beer that was really great. It has like a little owl on it, I think.
Which
one? It's like some ale.
It's Hitachino.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah,
unbelievable.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
The first guys to ever pour me the Hitachino were the guys over at it was Jimmy Bradley's restaurant. And it was like $10. $10. But it was, you know, it said it was Japanese. And, you know, me being a Japanophile that I am, I couldn't help it.
Yeah, there's a great beer that I had in Colorado that comes in a can, and I was like, what are you guys, crazy? My brother turned me on to it. It's from Lyons, Colorado. And it's like an oatmeal stout, and they make a couple other ones now. But I swear, I've never had canned beer that was so intoxifying and, like, unbelievable flavor. Just, I'll have to bring you a can over just for you to try it, because
I will be here waiting for that can.
Okay.
In the meantime, here you go.
Oh, thank you. Arigato.
Arigatoumashite. I don't know which one you have. They have both. They have like the red.
I think
rice
the red one. I think I had. Wow, that's really good.
This is amazing.
It has really orange kind of like a
on it. Orange, clove, little citrus,
cinnamon too.
It's
and you know that sounds so dorky to sound like, oh, I'm like, it's like tasting wine, but it really is. I mean, I think beer is really underappreciated in a lot of ways.
But this beer, even to like someone who isn't like that, is going to say the same thing. They're going to be like, wow, like that tastes, I mean, it's a very different
beer. Because if you go to really a general sushi sort of place, you get a Sapporo or, you know, the old
Asahi.
Standards. Yeah.
Right. Nothing wrong with
Asahi. No, nothing. You know? Nothing bad with it because it's nice and cold and quenching, so it's the spot. Wow. And how hard is it to get a little spot in your restaurant for dinner?
Honestly, it depends what time. Mm-hmm. You know, we get to the point where between 7:30 and 8:30, it's just like, look, it's like we're in the suburbs. That's when everybody wants to come in.
Yeah.
So you come a little bit later, you know, come in around 9:30, you're good to go.
Yeah.
Or conversely, come in a little earlier.
Yeah, the pre-dinner crowd.
Yeah, it's no sweat.
Which is always a good thing, I think. Get the best of everything.
And get the full attention of the staff before they get crushed, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, hopefully you can come in and let us cook for you soon.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time and hope you can listen to the pod one of these days.
Yeah. What is this thing, anyway?
Well, like what I do is I just download it to my computer, edit it, and then I stick the interview for iPod or podcasting. Or you can just listen to it on the site.
That's awesome. God, just one life is never enough, you know?
Yeah. Not enough time in the world.